WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina. This is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. There is a place in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, thousands of miles from any mainland, equidistant from New Zealand and North America. It is a circular string of about 26 tiny islands, nestled among several lagoons, surrounded by 15,000 acres of shallow turquoise reefs and deep blue submerged reefs. Palmyra Atoll National Wildlife Refuge is part of the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument. In the year 2000, the Nature Conservancy purchased the atoll to protect this endangered marine wilderness and also to establish a place for conservation scientists to conduct their work. In 2001, the U.S. Department of the Interior named it a wildlife refuge. And 8 years later, in 2009, President George W. Bush established the Pacific Remote Islands Marine National Monument, which includes this 26-island atoll known as Palmyra. Although it's still owned by the Nature Conservancy, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service manages what is the world's largest protected marine area. Dr. Joe Pollack is the senior coral reef resilience scientist for the Nature Conservancy's Hawaii and Palmyra programs. We're about to find out on this edition of Coastline what he's learning about coral reef restoration and what Palmyra is teaching us about climate change, ocean plastics, and whether we've reached a point of no return. Dr. Joe Pollack, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you for having me.
Also with us today, Kaylin Hernandez. She is the owner of Wilmington Outdoor Adventures, which offers eco-tours within the coastal plain of North Carolina. It's a relatively new business venture she started just before the pandemic shut down the world. Then the Nature Conservancy called. She accepted their offer to serve as Palmyra Preserve Manager for 4 months. She has completed that mission and is back in the Cape Fear region. Kaylin Hernandez, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel. I'm really excited to be here.
It's good to have both of you here. So help us kind of picture what we're talking about here. What is an atoll, Dr. Pollack, and how is Palmyra Atoll shaped?
Yeah, atolls are a pretty remarkable geological feature. So you can figure, you have to kind of set your mind to very long time spans to understand how they're built. So if you can imagine a volcanic island, something like the islands of Hawaii, they grow up and they're these mountains growing out of the sea. Over time, coral reefs start to develop around the fringing areas, the shallow water areas of those mountains. And then over time, as things happen, those volcanic mountains start to erode down. They start out huge, then they're smaller and smaller and smaller, until at one point, the emergent land, the volcano is no longer there. And all that remains is the coral reefs that have continued to grow up and up and up over time, laying down their calcium carbonate skeleton, which turns into sand as parrotfish and other fishes munch them. And what you're left with is these beautiful white sand atolls that sometimes have land, in many cases, covered in beautiful birds and trees. And that's how it is at Palmyra Atoll. It's you can think of it kind of like as an oval of islands around a series of lagoons. And outside of those lagoons and outside of those islands are some of the world's most beautiful and pristine coral reefs. And on those lands and on those islands, there's thriving seabird colonies, beautiful forests, and really just some of the most remarkable and breathtaking places you'll ever get the chance to visit.
Kaylin Hernandez, as Palmyra Preserve Manager, that's a little bit of a tongue twister or lip twister. We're going to get to what you were doing. But so we've got this oval of tiny little islands. Mm-hmm. Can you walk from one islet to another? Are there inhabitants? What does it look like when you fly in?
There are no permanent inhabitants of Palmyra. The only people who are allowed to go to Palmyra are research scientists and staff and volunteers with either the Nature Conservancy or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You can sail there on your boat if you have a permit to do so, and you can only stay for 7 days. So no permanent inhabitants whatsoever. You can walk from one island to the other in a few locations, but on the whole, you cannot. You have to boat to get from one island to the next. Back in World War II, some causeways were built that did connect islands that had not been connected before then.
And so all of the researchers and the staff stay on the one island that has some infrastructure.
That's right, and that's Cooper's Island. And that's the island that is completely owned and managed by the Nature Conservancy. It's where all of the infrastructure is. It's where the kitchen is. It's where the bungalows are that everyone stays in, and our offices and common areas and all of it that we have there, our solar array, our catchment tanks, it's all on Cooper.
I want to get into the history of this island, but first, Dr. Joe Pollack, why is Palmyra Atoll such a good place to study coral reefs?
Yeah, great question. I mean, as you and very likely your listeners know, coral reefs are incredibly valuable. They make up less than 1% of the Earth's surface, yet they provide sustenance to 500 million people. They provide $300 billion every single year in income for coastal communities. But reefs right around the world are under threat. We've seen a loss of about 50% coral cover globally around the world. And so as scientists and as conservationists, we really need to understand what can make for a healthy reef system, and how can we export those things that are making the healthy reefs healthy to other places around the world. And at Palmyra, we really have a gold standard for what a healthy, resilient coral reef ecosystem can and should look like. And we're able to see the really strong connections between the land, the coral reef, and the deep sea, and how those connections can be conserved and honestly can be restored through effective management action. And it really just gives us a playbook for how we can start to export the health and the vibrancy of Palmyra's reefs to other places around the world.
How does the health of coral reefs affect other components of that ecosystem? I mean, can the health of coral reefs actually affect the health of other species, other terrestrial species? What's the connection there?
Absolutely. I mean, we as humans tend to make these false distinctions between above water and below water. And just because we can see what's above water when we're above water and we can't see what's below, and we can see what's below water when we're snorkeling and not see above, it sort of lends this idea that they're not deeply interconnected, but in fact they are. So we can see, I'm sure Kaylin will talk a little bit more about how seabirds will go off and they'll fish in the deep waters and they'll bring, you know, those nutrients back in their bellies and poop them out, which is washed onto the coral reefs and helps to bolster the resilience and the productivity of those reef systems, which in turn provide habitat. Coral reefs provide habitat for 25% of all marine species, including those fish species that are going to be feeding the birds, that are going to be bringing the nutrients from those fish back to the land, washed in with the poop, onto the reef. So it's a cycle, and it's a deeply interconnected cycle. And if you start to disrupt any part of it, the system can fall apart.
The history of Palmyra is actually fascinating, Kaylin Hernandez. There's an old story about a pirate ship that crashed on the reef in the early 1800s, and mm-hmm. So the pirates buried their treasure there because they couldn't get off the reef. Is there still any talk of that? And is that just... It wouldn't be urban legend. It would be like remote island legend. But, yeah. You know, is that a thing still?
I think there are so many stories and, you know, ghost stories even surrounding Palmyra. And those were often the topic around bonfires and scientists that have been coming there for 10 and 20 years to do research. And those stories are just built up over time. But, yeah, for sure, the Esperanza was the ship that ran aground there. And there's... It's rumored that there may still be treasure there.
<There's>, she says with a like flick of her head.
There's also the infamous murders that took place there in the 1970s. There was a book called And the Sea Will Tell about that. And I read that book while I was on Palmyra. And it turns out that the murders that took place there were right around where my very secluded lagoon cabin was located. So a lot of stories, a lot of ghost stories surrounding Palmyra and the history of it.
The U.S. has owned mm-hmm. Palmyra for since what? I mean, they used it during World War II. How did they use it then?
It was a naval station in World War II. And so back in World War II, Palmyra was really devastated by the military's use of the atoll back then. It was never used for nuclear testing, fortunately, but it was very much modified in order to provide that military base there. And one of the wonderful things about Palmyra is that it has shown such an amazing ability to be resilient to those kinds of impacts because it's so far away. It's one of the most remote and isolated places on the planet. It's shown all this resilience. There's minimal human impact there today and hasn't been since World War II. And it's just really come back to be this super healthy, viable ecosystem.
And there's still work going on to bring Palmyra back to its original natural state. Is that what's the divergence right now? And I'm not sure if this would be a question for you, Kaylin, or Dr. Joe Pollack, but what is the original state of Palmyra that you're seeking to get back to?
Joe, I'll toss this one to you.
Sure, yeah. We're trying to get back to a pristine coral reef atoll. We're not far off now, but we've gotten there through a lot of intentional, difficult work. So as Kaylin said, during World War II, when the atoll served as the naval air base, they connected all of the islands around the atoll. They cut off circulation.
And you know what, Joe? I'm going to jump in here and I'm going to have you finish this story when we come back for the break. Promised you I'd do this. You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring Palmyra Atoll in the center of the Pacific Ocean with Dr. Joe Pollack and Kaylin Hernandez. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Kaylin Hernandez worked for the Nature Conservancy as Palmyra Preserve Manager for 4 months. The job meant she had to travel to a tiny remote grouping of islets in the middle of the Pacific Ocean to supervise and facilitate teams of researchers. Dr. Joe Pollack, one of those researchers, is the senior coral reef resilience scientist for the Nature Conservancy's Hawaii and Palmyra programs. He's working to develop a set of protocols to monitor the recovery of Palmyra's lagoon ecosystems. And Dr. Joe Pollack, just before we went to break, I had asked you about the recovery process and what the ultimate goal is, what a natural, original, pristine state for Palmyra Atoll means.
Yeah, it means healthy and robust systems where we have the terrestrial or the land areas where seabirds, coconut crabs, native forests are thriving. It means getting back to a place where the nearshore marine environments, so the coral reefs, are at the historic levels of incredibly high coral cover, fish diversity, fish and shark abundance. And it means getting back to a place where those terrestrial nearshore environments are also supporting and relying on very healthy deep water oceanic systems, where we have large pelagic fish and sharks, and where those systems are bolstering and supporting one another to drive further resilience as we move into a period of rapidly changing climates.
Kaylin Hernandez, so you got the call from the Nature Conservancy to become Palmyra Preserve Manager for 4 months. Mm-hmm. So this is not a permanent job. This is something that people do in shifts, and you did one of the longer shifts. Why is it something that they have to rotate people in and out of? What are you doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's because Palmyra is in such a remote and isolated location on the planet, it's better for everyone's well-being that these crews come in for ideally they've learned 3 months at a time. So the crews fly in together and then they fly out together. And now those seasons will be at 3 months. I served as preserve manager with a crew that did 4 months for the last time for TNC. From now on, they'll have 3 month positions. So if I go back to Palmyra, it will be in December and it will only be for 3 months this time.
And what did you do to make them shorten the time?
Oh,
I'm kidding. But what are some of the challenges that you face? I mean, we all know a little bit about isolation from having been through a pandemic for much longer than we thought. But specifically, what are some of the things that surprised you about the remote challenges on the atoll?
Yeah. I think that as an independent woman who has spent a lot of my time alone and doing adventurous things alone, backpacking alone, surfing alone, I thought that I could easily live on a place like Palmyra that is so abundant with wildlife. And the job itself just fit me like a glove, and I felt like I would probably be able to stay there forever. But the biggest challenge was that you aren't only working with the people that you're supervising, but you're living with them. So you're with these people 24/7. And as supervisor to them all, I had to maintain a level of professionalism that entire time, 24/7. So the cabin was secluded, and that helped to be able to go and decompress and get some peace there. But the thing that really helped me out is that I had a good friend that established a chat on WhatsApp called the Palmyra Daily Mantra, where my closest friends would get one picture from me a day, and then we would have a conversation. And that allowed me to have contact with the outside world, with people that I love who care and support me in what I was doing. And that really helped me reduce the feeling of isolation on Palmyra.
You say that you're supervising these teams of researchers. What does that mean? I mean, are there times, of course, with any group of humans, you're going to have conflict. But what do the conflicts tend to be about? Why does that tend to be challenging?
I think that when you have a group of people who are adventurous enough and skilled enough and have the background that's strong enough to be chosen to be on the crew at Palmyra, then you have strong personalities. And so you throw strong personalities in the mix in the middle of the ocean on a small isolated island, and there are bound to be challenges.
Sounds like a reality show.
But luckily, I've truly had a wonderful crew. While I was there, there were no issues among crew members. We all got along super well and ended up feeling like a big family, and it was really difficult to part ways in the end.
Yeah. And you made some connections on the island that we'll talk about later in the program. But Dr. Joe Pollack, so you run the coral reef resilience programs for both Hawaii and Palmyra. Why is Palmyra a better place to study coral reefs than Hawaii?
Yeah, I would say that it's not a better place. I would say that it's an important part of the equation. So whenever we're trying to understand any system, we need to understand the places that where the system's working well, and we need to understand the places where the systems are working not so well. And unfortunately, now on planet Earth, we have a lot of opportunities to study coral reef systems that are not working well. But we have very few systems that are actually in such a pristine state as Palmyra Atoll. So one of the important things that studying pristine places like Palmyra does is it helps us to fight the shifting baselines problem. So, you know, if you're just used to seeing degraded systems, that becomes your baseline. That becomes the thing that you think is normal. Whereas if you have a robust, healthy, thriving system like Palmyra, you can understand what it's actually supposed to work like, and you can fight that shifting baselines problem. So for that reason, it's incredibly valuable.
And so Palmyra is described as having shallow turquoise reefs and deep blue submerged reefs. What are the differences in those kinds of reefs?
Sure. Yeah. So corals, typically we think of shallow water corals. So we think of these ones that are living in very clean, very clear water right near the ocean surface that we can go snorkeling to. And honestly, with our snorkel above the water, see them down below us. The fact of the matter is that corals can live in a number of different environments. So you can have corals that are actually what we call that are not symbiotic. So the shallow water corals are reliant on this plant-like algae that they have a symbiosis with that takes in light, captures the energy from that light, and shares that with the corals. Those are, most of the shallow corals. But you can actually have corals living in deep oceans and deep seas that don't even have those symbionts at all, that they get their nutrients from trapping prey. For me, it's helpful to think about the relationship between the coral animal and jellyfish. They're very closely related. And just like jellyfish, coral have tentacles. They can sting prey, they can eat it, and they can bring in that energy. That's the main source of energy for deep water corals, whereas that symbiotic relationship with the photosynthetic algae is what brings in the energy for the shallow water corals.
How many different kinds of corals are there around Palmyra?
There are hundreds of species. I would love to give you the exact number off the top of my head, but the fact of the matter is, the more we look, the more we find. The study of coral species and coral, what we would call taxonomy, is developing every single day. And it really does seem like the more we look at Palmyra and the more we look around the world, the more species of coral we find. But there's hundreds and hundreds of coral species at Palmyra.
And so it has this healthier coral reef system than you might encounter in many other parts of the world. And Kaylin Hernandez, you actually started to notice, sadly, the death of corals and coral reefs in other places that you've lived.
I did, yeah. Worked and lived in the Florida Keys back in the 90s. I worked for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back then, and then for the Department of Environmental Protection within the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, and was in the water all the time. And during the time that I was there, I saw some decline of the health of coral within the sanctuary. And then I moved to an island in the Caribbean called St. Eustatius, where I managed three nature parks, and one of those was a marine park that was a protected area that surrounded the island from the high water mark to 30 meters in depth, and there was a lot of coral. Two really great reserves of coral there that were set aside for as no-take zones to protect the fish within those areas as well. And so I would say over a 10-year period, I noticed a decline. I'm just working on coral and the health of those corals. But what was really striking is when I got out of that field and started working for a consulting firm and then a nonprofit here for a while, I wasn't diving for a living anymore. So I would go on trips, usually surf trips, and try and throw in a dive while I'm there. And that's when it really was so evident to me the degradation of coral reefs. I would go to a spot where the tour guide would say, "This is one of our healthiest coral reefs. You know, you'll see all this coral and all these fish." I'd go down and see not many fish and mostly dead coral, bleached and diseased, and pop up and with tears in my eyes on the surface. And that was really one of the main reasons why I wanted to get to Palmyra, because I wanted to see a healthy coral reef ecosystem again and have a part in facilitating that important science that's being done to protect it.
So is that an example of what Dr. Joe Pollack was talking about in terms of shifting baselines? An eco tour guide is telling you that this is a great place to dive, and you, who know what a healthy system looks like, you're seeing death.
Right, right. So without a place like Palmyra, where you do have a thriving ecosystem, including a coral reef ecosystem, without a place like that to establish a baseline as to what a healthy reef ecosystem looks like, you might be using other areas that are already damaged, and that's not a good place to start.
Yeah, you're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Kaylin Hernandez, Palmyra Preserve Manager, about Palmyra Atoll, a string of about 26 tiny islets in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We're also talking with Dr. Joe Pollack, conservation scientist. He heads up the Coral Reef Resilience Program for Hawaii and Palmyra programs. Dr. Pollack, you started this project to look at what it would take to help Palmyra's lagoon ecosystems recover. And you began phase one with satellite imagery, looking for changes to the atoll's lagoons, both topographic and bathymetric. And first of all, when we say bathymetric, what are we talking about?
So if folks have heard of topographics, so that's like the shape of the earth above water. Bathymetric basically just means the shape of the ground underneath of the water.
And so what did you see then from the satellite imagery? What did that tell you?
Yeah, so just to create a little bit of context. So as we discussed before, the atoll had these major changes during World War II with the Naval Air Station. All of these islands were connected together, major dredging occurred, and that resulted in essentially the cutoff of fresh water flowing, fresh cool water flowing into the atoll's lagoons. Corals, as we discussed, are this symbiosis between a coral animal and an algae like, a plant like algae. And when the water gets too hot, you get coral bleaching. So that symbiosis breaks down, the coral lose their algae, they lose their major source of food, and they turn white. And if the water temperatures don't come down, they die. So what seems to have happened is during World War II, when that water flow got cut off, the cool water couldn't come in. Those lagoons kind of turned into hot water baths. And so these previously thriving coral reef ecosystems turned into essentially wastelands of dead coral skeleton. Now it's important to distinguish that's what's happening in the lagoon. Importantly, outside of the lagoons on the fringing reef areas, we do have these pristine reefs. And your question was, what did we see from the satellite imagery? And what we saw is that those connections that were human made during World War II, they're starting to break down. So we start to see nature starting to take back over through erosional processes, where we're starting to get that flow of water back from the deep, cool ocean into the lagoon.
So the damage to Palmyra's coral reefs in the lagoon is entirely human created, and it's from the activity, the human activity that went on during World War II. Is that right?
That's our understanding. You know, things would likely be exacerbated by current changes with climate change, et cetera. But the best evidence we have is that these reefs have been decimated for quite a long time, largely dating back to those World War II era modifications to the atoll.
Kaylin Hernandez, there was other research going on while you were on Palmyra. What were some of the other quests for understanding that took place that struck you as pretty fascinating?
Yeah, all of the research going on Palmyra to me is fascinating, and that the science teams that were there during my time, it's no different. I was really excited to get to know some of these researchers and to try and understand what they were doing there. And of course, my position as preserve manager is to facilitate the science that's going on there so that their time on the atoll, the short amount of time they have to do this very important research, goes smoothly with the facilities there and everything they're depending on to be able to conduct that research. So the first team that came flew in about 2 weeks after the crew was there initially, and it was the Corallomorph team. So this was a team made up of scientists from USGS, someone with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and also representative of the Nature Conservancy. And what they were doing, there's a zoanthid called Corallomorph that was starting to become too prolific on Palmyra's reefs. And so although it's a native species, when it becomes too prolific, it's a coral killer. And so it can cause some damage. And so they were trying to figure out methodology for reducing the impact, reducing the number of Corallomorph within Palmyra. So they were mixing paste, and that was one of the methods that they were testing. They were putting paste directly on the corallomorph. And so they were using quadrats to determine, to do the distance and measure it and keep track of everything, then go back and see how effective the paste was on the corallomorph. How much did it kill? How long did it take to kill it? And then they used a second method using hot water on the corallomorph and did the same thing, tested how much of the corallomorph it actually killed and how long it took to kill it. And so like so many studies on Palmyra, they'll use the results of this study to inform this type of research being done around the world. So what they found in this case was that the paste was more effective than the hot water. And so so we'll move on from there, using the paste more likely than the hot water treatment. So that was the first study that came, and that was the crew that stayed the longest amount of time on Palmyra. They were there for over 5 weeks, I believe, with us. So they pitched in with activities on the island. They helped, like, clean the shower block, and, you know, they helped clean up after dinners. And so a lot of these teams ended up being a lot like family, too, because we were all living and working together in this little place. So great, great team. And then the next team that came was with University of California, Santa Barbara. And they were conducting scientific benthic measures, and they were using really state-of-the-art technology to map out the benthic coral reef habitats. And at the end of their term there, they gave us a really inspiring presentation in the commons, one that I'll never forget. So Dr. Jen Cassell leads that up, and she's just an amazing scientist that has really been an ambassador for healthy coral reef systems around the world.
And I'm really interested to hear why you found that presentation so inspiring. Think it has something to do with feeling like we haven't reached the point of no return?
That's it. I think a lot of us that are in the science community become jaded and feel like there's no hope. Her presentation left us with the knowledge that there is hope. We have to find these hot spots, these spots like Palmyra, hope spots, I should say, around the world, and make sure that we do our best to protect those areas. And that's a mission that she's on right now. And she believes there's hope. If Jen Cassell believes there's hope, then so do I.
You're listening to Coastline. I'm talking with Kaylin Hernandez and Dr. Joe Pollock, who work with the Nature Conservancy on Palmyra Atoll in the Pacific Ocean. When we come back from this short break, how this research could inform our understanding of climate change. Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're exploring Palmyra Atoll, a string of 26 islets in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, part of a protected marine ecosystem owned by the Nature Conservancy and managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Palmyra Atoll is an outpost for a range of conservation research. Dr. Joe Pollock, one of those researchers, is the senior coral reef resilience scientist for the Nature Conservancy's Hawaii and Palmyra programs. Kaylin Hernandez, local owner of Wilmington Outdoor Adventures, served as Palmyra Preserve Manager for 4 months. Dr. Joe Pollock, the next phase of your work involved drone imagery and drone footage. What can you see from the drone footage that you can't see from satellite imagery?
Great question. The answer is you can see a lot more from the drone imagery. So, you know, from some of the satellite imagery, we can start to see large trees on the land. We can see some generally darkened areas that might be reef. When we get in there with some of our high resolution drones, we can see down to individual coral colonies. We tie that drone imagery, which we fly to cover the entire atoll and the entire lagoon system, we tie that up with really high resolution underwater photography. So we know exactly where those photos are being taken so that we can start to train up machine learning algorithms to say from that drone imagery, this darkened pointy patch is that coral? Is that live coral? Is that dead coral? Is that sand? So that we can actually map out, you know, a huge number of coral colonies throughout the entire lagoon. We can see where they're starting to recover, where they're starting to grow, and importantly, where they're not, so that we can figure out what aspects do those areas where they're starting to recover have in common that we would want to bolster and support and make sure that there's more of. And the areas where they're not starting to bounce back, what's happening there that's preventing that? So if we can take all of these different layers from satellites to drones to diver and snorkeler-based imagery, we can start to tell a really strong and compelling story about what's happening with those reef systems and extract lessons that help us better conserve the reefs at Palmyra and help to inform reef conservation in other places around the world.
And so at this point, you've said that you're learning that some of the restoration of the reefs is happening just naturally, just because some of the man-made barriers are opening up naturally. They're getting eroded and washing away and cool water's coming in. How much do you think, or what do you know at this point about what humans will have to do to help that recovery process?
Yeah, that's a great question. From what I've seen from this most recent trip that I just returned from last weekend, we are seeing some really rapid expansion of coral reefs in areas where that flow is returning. And importantly, that's happening naturally. I tend to believe, you know, I'm a conservation scientist, and a lot of the focus in some cases on what can we do as humans. I think it's also really important to think about what can we do if we as humans step back and let nature take its course. Mm-hmm. So in this case, you know, I would say that that's the default. If we can step back, let nature recover itself, that's amazing. And so I'd say that's the first step. Let's understand what's happening naturally, how that's starting to recover. But importantly, we're seeing some areas where that recovery isn't happening. So the Eastern Lagoon, beautiful recovery. The Western Lagoon, it doesn't seem to be recovering quite as well. That could be because there's this north-south causeway, this attachment of what used to be a road that's really interfering with flow from the east to the west. So if we can learn lessons from what's naturally happening, find places where the natural recovery isn't occurring, then we can understand what we as humans may need to do. And it may be as simple as helping to start the natural process of erosion and then let nature take its course after that.
Helping to start the natural process of erosion. So is that something that you could take to more inhabited parts of the world or areas with coral reefs that have more human traffic?
Yeah, so here, this is a little bit of a unique system where it's such a closed off system. But what we can learn about that is what makes reefs thrive. So from here, we're learning the importance of flow. So, you know, you can learn lessons if you're going to be building human infrastructure. Make sure that you're still leaving space for water to come in and to come out. We're also learning about the incredible importance of having what we would call seed reefs. So those are healthy reefs nearby that can produce baby corals that can flow through the water and settle down. So even if you remove the local environmental stressors, if you don't have a source of new baby corals, you're going to have a really hard time getting that recovery. So we're starting to learn about the environmental conditions that lead to resilient reefs. We're also learning about the biological conditions, things like connectivity, larval supply that can help keep reefs healthy and that can help degraded reefs start to recover.
Can humans speed along the larval supply? I mean, is that something that is considered part of the natural process or part of the human process?
There's a gradient. So you can have completely natural supply of larvae where humans are involved in no way. If that's happening, that is fantastic. In places where coral reefs are extremely degraded, so for example, in the Caribbean, I've been involved with organizations and partners whose sole focus is on using coral larvae, using coral babies for coral reef restoration. So SeaCore International is an excellent example of that. Their mission is to understand how we can take baby corals from healthy reefs, grow them up to the phase where they're viable, where they can live, and then help to settle them down onto reefs so that they can grow and they can thrive. I mean, one thing that blows my mind is that once, you know, just a handful of fairly large coral colonies can produce hundreds of thousands of baby corals. But in a natural setting, there's a big bottleneck to that survival. Just like you hear about baby sea turtles, you know, the survival rates are really low. In nature, the survival rates of wild coral larvae are incredibly low. And if we can take a couple of steps to help them get through those critical bottlenecks, if we can get those hundreds of thousands of coral larvae to become hundreds of thousands of coral babies, that is a really great opportunity to do some large scale coral reef restoration on reefs that are extremely degraded.
So once you've developed this set of protocols, is that something that could inform public policy?
I believe so. I mean, I think that, you know, it's really hard to manage a system that you don't understand, right? You can't manage what you don't know and what you're not seeing. And like we talked about before, you know, a lot of times the coral reef systems are out of sight, out of mind. Traditionally, reef monitoring is done by folks like myself. I've done it a bunch of times, going down on scuba, and you can only cover a very small area. You can, you know, identify a handful of corals, say how healthy they are, et cetera, but it's in a really small footprint. But when we can start to leverage new and emerging technologies like high-resolution satellite imagery, drones, the ability to create these 3D recreations of the reefs from drone imagery or diver-based imagery, we can dramatically increase our footprint for monitoring. We can be able to say where things are working well, where they're not. And as we start to implement conservation and restoration actions, we can understand and what we call adaptively manage those conservation actions. So where they're working well, we keep doing the same thing. Where they're not working well, we understand that very quickly, and we can shift course to a more productive avenue of conservation action.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of Palmyra Atoll, a string of 26 tiny islands in the center of the Pacific Ocean, part of a national wildlife refuge and an outpost for conservation scientists to conduct their research. Dr. Joe Pollack is the senior coral reef resilience scientist for the Nature Conservancy's Hawaii and Palmyra programs, and Caitlin Hernandez was the Nature Conservancy's Palmyra Preserve manager for 4 months. She's also the owner of Wilmington Outdoor Adventures. And Caitlin Hernandez, you said that in this place, this very one of the possibly the most remote places on Earth, the remotest, can you say that? You still saw ocean plastic.
Ah, that's correct. Right. It was pretty disheartening, but also not a surprise, understanding the way plastic travels around our oceans. It was just a very clear reminder that our use of single-use plastic and how we dispose of it is so important. When it ends up in the oceans, it ends up breaking down into microplastics, and sometimes not even breaking down into microplastics before it ends up somewhere like on Palmyra in the middle of nowhere. So it was not as littered with plastic as I have seen in other places that were fairly remote. But still, one of the first things I did as preserve manager there was to organize a community day to do a beach cleanup of North Beach, which is one of the most magical places on Earth. But it was littered with plastic, and it was just heartbreaking. And so we spent a day cleaning that up. But it's not something that we can do on Palmyra, on all of the islands around. We don't have the capacity to get rid of the plastic once we collect it. It would have to be shipped off on a container somewhere else to be dealt with. And so there just isn't the capacity to deal with all of that plastic. So, yeah, really disheartening. It's something that you see worldwide, even in the most remote location on the planet, like Palmyra.
And we've talked a little bit about the fact that there are large nesting colonies of different kinds of birds. Mm-hmm. Want to hear about those, but we have to get to the story of George Clooney before we get to that. So I want you to explain to me what a tornado is. But first, why, George Clooney on Palmyra Atoll? Help me understand.
Well, two of the most common questions I've been asked since returning from Palmyra. The first is, what did a typical day on Palmyra look like? Which is almost impossible to answer, because the only two things that were typical about a day was that we would have breakfast at 7:30 and dinner at 1800. And also, I had to be on base station most every day, taking a detailed log of boating activity to keep everyone safe. And then the second question that a lot of people ask, knowing that I'm a single female, was, did I make any connection on Palmyra? And so I answer, yes, I did. Palmyra has a really healthy population of manta rays, and I had never seen a manta ray before going to Palmyra. I was really excited to see one.
You had never seen one?
I had not, and I had lived and worked in the Caribbean where there are manta rays, but mostly I would see southern stingrays and spotted eagle rays, but never a manta ray. So I was really excited to see the manta rays. And they have a manta light on station, and they are drawn to light. And so almost any evening, crew could go down and science teams could go down to the manta light and just see manta rays swimming around right there within feet of yourselves. So there were from 2 to 6 mantas that would be there at the light every evening. And there was one manta ray in particular that I felt like was reaching out for me more so than the other humans. And so after people would go to bed, we'd turn the manta light off, and often I would sneak back to the manta light, turn it back on, and only this one manta would come back. And most manta rays have some light white markings on their back, but this one was almost entirely dark. So he was dark and handsome, and we had a connection for sure, and I named him George Clooney.
And how do you know that he was connecting with you?
You know, I didn't realize how intelligent manta rays are until I went there and then did a little research of my own. But they're highly intelligent. They're one of the few species that have passed the mirror test. It's a self-awareness test, self-recognition test. So other species that have passed it are elephants, certain apes, dolphins, and now manta rays. So they are highly intelligent, and you can just feel it, and you can just – they have one of the largest brains. But when they look at you, they tilt their head and just look directly into your eye, and you just know that you're looking at an intelligent, sentient being.
Just a couple of minutes left. What's a tornado?
So one of the things that I had to do as preserve manager is to make sure that these sooty terns would not nest on the runway. The runway was primary was like excellent nesting habitat for them, because they like to nest directly on the ground. And so for them to be nesting on the runway would be disastrous, because that's how we bring all of our supplies and science teams and everything. That coral runway has to be clear of eggs and birds. So they would do this high flight mating ritual where they're flying around like a tornado, identifying their mate that way. And then once they identified their mate, they would immediately go down to the ground and lay an egg. Sometimes they would even lay an egg before they hit the ground. They would lay so fast, it would happen so quickly. So we always had to be on the lookout for these tornadoes, making sure that they weren't near the runway. And if they became near the runway, we would have to set out these cannons. The cannons would just blast a sound, and that was enough to deter them from landing on the runway. So that was just one of the many things that were typical but not typical, because it didn't happen every day, which is why that question is really hard for me to answer.
And we could have a whole discussion, I'm sure, about another hour about the birds that you encountered.
Yeah.
But your first night in the preserve manager's cabin, you were awakened in the middle of the night to what? By what?
Oh, man. So I woke up around midnight to splashing. So the cabin was about 10 to 15 feet off the water's edge, depending on the tide. And this night I woke up because the splashing was so loud, and I got my headlamp and shined it on the water's edge, and there was a black-tipped shark right there hunting for fish. So 15 feet from where my feet would be in bed, there's a black-tipped shark hunting, splashing all around, and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm definitely not in Wilmington, North Carolina anymore.
Was that scary? Are black-tipped sharks aggressive towards humans?
No, they're not, and they were everywhere on Palmyra. You would look out over the beautiful lagoon and just see black. They're very, very recognizable black-tipped dorsal just slicing through the waters everywhere. Almost any time you got in the water, you would see a black tip.
And that's this edition of Coastline. I knew it would go fast. Kaylin Hernandez, Dr. Joe Pollack, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Thanks also to the Nature Conservancy for making this on-air discussion possible. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Jonathan Furnell engineered this episode. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. You can find the episode at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.